Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island change procrastination in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is all good for the economy, because now everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest from GnosticMedia.com is the stunningly able and capable Jan Irvin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vinny. Thanks for having me back.
Okay. Now, first of all, proviso, during the last show, I think it was on Friday that we had about you, I actually told a lie. Well, a mistake, actually, because there was a little bit of a chronology mix-up there. However, I called Jan Irvin a liar, ladies and gentlemen, for saying that the previous guest, Tom Hatzis, didn't challenge him to a debate. I thought Jan was talking about before the interview, and Jan was talking about before the interview, and I thought he was talking about after the interview where he had, and so that was just a complete mistake on my part, and it's absolutely not true. Jan didn't lie. Just wanted to get that retraction there out of the way as quickly as possible. Whew. Now, it's been a I apologize for my state. I've had a pretty intense couple of weeks full of work. So, Jan, if you would lead off.
I get that. What, yeah. You need me to take over there?
Please do.
Like when I was on with Joe Atwill, when we just kind of took over the whole interview for you there for a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, you had the knowledge. I hadn't finished your article that you'd written.
Well, no, I think what happened was your line was dropped, and we just picked up the interview and just pretended like nothing happened, you know?
Like professionals do.
Right. Exactly. Well, you know what I was thinking? I think we only had like 12 or 15 or 20 minutes on Friday to even go over some of the stuff. So then, you know, what I was thinking was, you know, rather than rush through it all and just blah, like I was trying to do on Friday, what I'll do is I'll just go back through, you know, the key points and just touch on them one by one so that it's all cogent and coherent, et cetera. But, you know, starting off, Tom makes the false statement that, let's see.
Well, can I interject here, sure. Actually? Would you be able to elaborate? Because you said that there's a group of people, a group of characters out there who are always out trying to attack you and defame you. Could you enlighten the audience as to that paradigm? Sure.
I mean, you know, they kind of center around Simon Powell and Johnny Enoch, who this guy Tom Hatzis referenced last week, who was a friend of his who supposedly tried to attack me. But there's like, you know, they kind of, I guess, center around Reality Sandwich and this sort of group, but it's essentially a group that is propagandized to, well, the rest of the down folk are, but, you know, it's basically a group that's selling this agenda that we reveal in my recent article with Joe Atwill called Manufacturing the Deadhead, a Product of Social Engineering. And there's a lot of people that are victims of that, and a lot of people have bought into Terrence McKenna and the whole psychedelic movement as a religion, and they act like religious zealots. You know, and, you know, for instance, this guy, Johnny Enoch, he did a video, supposedly debunking my work in The Secret History of Magic Mushrooms, but he never even addressed a single thing that I actually wrote. You know, in fact, in the video, he says, quote unquote, citations are from Mars. So he had no interest in what I actually said or wrote. And, you know, his original attack on me was that, you know, when he first messaged me was that I had no right to talk about Terrence McKenna, a dead person, that he was 10 times the scholar as I, and how dare I criticize this guy? You know, we should, you know, if somebody's a criminal and we find out about it, we should put it out. It doesn't matter when we find out. We should put it out as soon as we find out, you know? So, you know, it's like either the second you realize that a fraud has been committed, you know, the second you realize that that's when the fraud was committed. You know, if you weren't aware of it before, you obviously can't bring it up. But whenever we discover something like that, we should put it out. I did get a kick out of your thing the other day on the trip up on the word philology. That was kind of funny. Well, you did finally get it right once or twice, so that was pretty good. But, You know, philology is actually the, it's the love of, you know, logos is essentially the word or, you know, the study of, and philo is love. So it's the, it's essentially the love of the word, right? So in other words,
philology is the study of the love of the word.
It's, well, no, it's actually, it's the study, philology is the study of words, essentially.
Uh-huh.
Their meanings, their origins, you know, taking it back through many different cultures. You know, John Allegro, he was a philologist. He was trained at Oxford, and he was one of the original eight philologists on the translation team of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Right. So
I find it interesting how a word that describes words and the study of words is so hard to pronounce.
Well, you know, you could always become an abecedarian.
I don't know what an abecedarian is. Is that some kind of
an abecedarian?
Like
is someone who studies an abecedarian is someone who studies their ABCs or studies the ABCs and the origins and all of that surrounding it. So it's abecedarian, abecedarian, right?
So it's not
and
a
so
dog. Like
actually,
it's not a dog like a Pomeranian.
No, it's actually where we get the word abracadabra from. Abracadabra. Right. Wow. So, and then of course, magic is all about spelling, and you know, the magi becomes the magistrate who writes the laws, et cetera. You know, these are direct links. And I did a show a few months back with Jose Barrera, and he exposed a lot of his new research on that area.
Now, over the weekend, did you get to spend much time with your boy, or did you spend it all trying to beef up?
Well, it was, you know, there was definitely a lot of time spent research, you know, preparing notes and things for the interview, but we did get some stuff done, and I did get him down to visit his grandmother for the afternoon on, what day was that, Friday or Saturday or something.
Let's see, we both got the kind of coughing thing at the moment.
Yeah, well, you know, and I've got cotton mouth too, so that's probably related to the cough.
Yeah, it could be. It could be.
Yeah.
Now, getting into this.
Got that. It was pun intended.
All right. So let's get into this sort of breaking down the Hatzis attack, because I think it's a microcosm of many attacks that are directed against you by a number of different individuals, sure. But they're all using the same tactics and saying more or less the same things, aren't they?
Well, and it's ironic because they're using the same tactics as they did against John Allegro in the first place, right? You know, but what we're dealing with here is all of these attacks going on. See, if my work is correct, especially on Gordon Wasson, then, and which is interesting that Tom Hatz has said he agreed with, and that was all original primary research that I did myself, and these are all documents that I acquired out of many different universities just on Gordon Wasson. This is also stuff out of the CIA archives, Hoover Institute, the CFR archives, etc.
For the listeners,
but it's interesting that he says that he
yeah, I'm holding up a massive box there, right. full of documents. Yeah.
Well, I just find it's funny that he says that he agrees with my research on Wasson, but that all of my research is crap, and that I don't know how to do research. But I'm the one who discovered all of the stuff on Wasson. Of course, none of these guys have ever asked me who attacked the work to actually see the documents. But here's the issue is if my work on Wasson is correct, then the entire field of ethnomycology and all of the scholars work within it for the last 55 years is impacted directly. And so, you know, many of them have come straight out and said, holy crap, you know, you're right. We got to put the brakes on this and reanalyze things. And others will say, well, you know, you've brought up some really good points, but I'm just not sure, but your conclusions might be wrong, and then they won't ever cite any of the things that don't add up, you know, and I'll ask them, you know, hey, let's sit down, let's go over the research, let's go over this, you know, box of documents here, and we can go over everything point by point and see what doesn't add up, and I've never had any one of these guys accept that offer, you know, but if Wasson's research is impacted, of course it's going to cause a lot of cognitive dissonance out there in the other researchers, you know, and especially people like Simon Powell and Daniel Pinchbeck and all of these guys that have, you know, Johnny Enoch, all of these guys that have themselves invested in this religion and are dedicated to it like zealots, regardless of where the information and citations take us. You know, and we need to be able to put our beliefs and our emotions aside and just look at the data, because you know what? I believe just like those guys did for years. And then going through, you know, when I was originally, it started in 2006, I was writing an article with Michael Hoffman about the debates over Wasson and Allegro and the Tree of Knowledge's Amanita muscaria. And so it was in the writing of that article when I was going through all of Allegro's entheogen citations. I literally checked out every single one in his whole book, and they all checked out. And that's when I started realizing that something was seriously wrong with the attacks on Allegro's work. And so it was around in 2007 when I was writing and putting together all of the notes that later became my book, The Holy Mushroom. It was in writing all of that when it occurred to me that there was no way that Wasson would just be putting out all of this disinfo and propaganda unless he was likely dirty in some way. And so it was around that time when I just started collecting notes, and anything that I found on Wasson that contradicted, you know, the official story of everything that went on, he and Valentina in the woods in New York. And for those who don't know, Wasson is the guy who supposedly discovered magic mushrooms. But what we found out was that, you know, and the story is that he's just a banker and, you know, just this guy, and he discovered it and everything. But we find out that he's actually working with the banking community. He's actually the vice president of propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank, working with and trained by Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda. And we also, found documentation that he's involved with the CIA, with the Council on Foreign Relations, and with the Century Club, which is sort of the East Coast version of Bohemian Grove. And it was headed up by, you know, guys like Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA. We had Eisenhower there. In fact, I've got a whole list right here of people that were members there, and I can read you who were these guys that Wasson and was hanging out with while he's attacking Allegro and selling the mushroom story. But we've got Dwight Eisenhower, Dwight Morrow, Ellsworth Bunker, Frank Altschul, George F. Kennan, who is the ambassador to the Soviet Union, Henry Luce, who founded Time Life, is there. John Dewey, who created the current compulsory education system to dumb down the kids, he's there. John Foster Dulles, the former Secretary of State. Alan Dulles' brother, John Maynard Keynes, the economist. Gordon Wasson, Vannevar Bush, Walter Lippmann, who was another propagandist at the same time as Edward Bernays. And it goes on from there. But these are the people who Wasson was working with. And it was Wasson.
That's like the Dirty Dozen, you know.
Well, the dirty few hundred, I would say, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and they're all connected in. They connect, interestingly, directly into the Bohemian Club on the West Coast up here, in, you know, here in California, up in the Bay Area. And Wasson, Aldous Huxley was a member of the Century Club as well there with Wasson and Alan Dulles. And so Wasson and Aldous Huxley were working on all of this stuff. And as far as I can tell, Aldous Huxley was guy number one behind the foundation of MKUltra. Now, I've got a database on my website for listeners who want to check it out. On the front page of the website, go to GnosticMedia.com. You'll see a blue icon there, the brain database. You can download the full database or you can use the online version. And just, you know, we've got over 6,000-7,000 citations through there, and you need to read each one. If when you open it up and you see the connections there, don't just think, oh, it's guilt by association or whatever. You know, there's actually citations in there. And this just, you know, connects the dots between each person and player, but you need to go through and read the citations and read the instructions on the website, how the database works.
Could I interject? Aldous Huxley wrote the book Brave New World. Sure. Now, it's been said that George Orwell wrote 1984 not as a warning, but as a blueprint.
Well, sure. Well,
for how to win
Orwell,
people. Do you believe the same is true of Aldous?
Well, George Orwell was Aldous's student. Okay. See, Aldous Huxley, yeah, I mean, it's possible that George Orwell, Eric Blair turned, you know, and tried to expose it, but I'm in doubt. And there's, you know, later on letters between he and, in fact, that I published in August in another article, between he and Aldous talking about the ultimate revolution and how it's going to play out. Now, if you get into Aldous's book, Moksha, like on page 56, there's a write-up there from October 25, 1954, where he's talking about Dr. Andrea Puhrich's LSD experiments. And Andrea Puhrich was MK Ultra and U.S. Army intelligence out of Edgewood, Maryland arsenal. You know, and so, you know, here before any of the MK Ultra or anything, any knowledge of these studies is out, here's Aldous with this information, discussing it in his letters with other researchers. But, you know, when you read his book, Moksha, you go through it, and he sits there and he's warning about all of this stuff going on. And then in the next letter, you see him like at one of the universities there looking at all of the studies they're doing and then telling the doctor what studies need to be done next, et cetera. Right. So he's like, you know, but you have to realize that he's a Fabian socialist, and the Fabian socialist is the wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah, this is true. Or the turtle with the hammer, I believe, is another Fabian socialist symbol. Move slowly, but strike hard with the final blow. We'll be right back after the break with Jan Irvin from GnosticMedia.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and Bernaysian propaganda public relations, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. And my very special guest is Jan Irvin. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I'm quite interested in the story that you were explaining about Aldous Huxley and the rise of this this MK Ultra movement.
Right. Well, you know, like I said before the break, Joe Atwill and I on May 13th we released a new article that covers a lot of this. And then let me pull it up here. You know, I forget the titles of my own articles and things sometimes. After you write something, it's hard to remember everything that you write. But the other one was...
Well, that's why you wrote it down, so you don't have to.
Exactly. You know, I've actually been attacked for not being able to remember all the titles of my books and stuff. You don't remember what you wrote? It was like 5 years ago, dude. So it's the other article, and it's under The Secret History of Magic Mushrooms, is how Darwin, Huxley, and the Esalen Institute launched the 2012 and psychedelic revolutions and began one of the largest mind control operations in history. And then, of course, you know, Sir Thomas Henry Huxley... Aldous Huxley and Julian Huxley's father was the propagandist for Darwin. And then Julian Huxley ran the British Eugenics Society and UNESCO, et cetera. And then they both basically take up all of their work, Aldous in the novels, and then Julian in his nonfiction books, go on to sell this agenda throughout their work.
Effect has this You're had muted. On society is actually had quite a lot of effect on society, hasn't it?
Because it's had a huge, yeah.
Lots of people were talking about 2012 in the lead up to it, and none of them have come out since and recused themselves and say, you know what, I was just a mind controlled idiot and I didn't know what the heck I was talking about.
Or even worse, they're part of the agenda, unlike Reality Sandwich right now with a Kickstarter video requesting more money so that they can come out with Reality Sandwich version 2.0, because obviously 1.0 went in the shitter.
We can't say that on FCC regulated radio. I apologize.
Excuse me, on the crutter.
Beep.
That was my bad, folks. I apologize.
It happens. Right, and I don't know what it is about this show that makes my guests feel comfortable enough to cuss, but it happens.
Well, when I was on your old show, it was everything was, everything was okay.
I think that might have been when we were recording off air, yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, when you're using language and all of that kind of stuff, there's certain things that are offensive and make people aggressive and so on and so forth. Okay, so you've been accused of being like what a liar, a fraud, and all these other things. And what I found interesting about the dynamic is one person can say one thing as an accusation with zero evidence attached to it, and in order to actually fully debunk and prove unequivocally that person's lying, it takes an inordinate quantity of citations and research and things of that nature, which you've actually put out since that previous interview.
Well, not only that, but I had already actually written a whole debunking of his article on February 16, and I had sent it to him, and then, of course, he omitted all of it in, you know, his radio interview with you and claimed that I never responded to him, et cetera. You know, and you know what? One thing that he actually said that I addressed all of the philology in my work. I never said that. What I said is that we addressed all of the entheogen stuff in my work. So, and he actually even paused and then asked you if that was what I said, because he, you know, he wasn't even quoting me or citing me. He was just thinking of things that might be right and then saying them as fact and then attacking me for things that I never said. But, you know, it's like he constantly cited Karl Ruck, right? Well, Karl Ruck actually did address all of Allegra's philology issues. And right here in the second 40th anniversary edition of John Allegra's book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, right in the very back, and I published this book, but right in the very back here is an article titled Fungus Redivivus by Karl A.P. Ruck. Now, I published that article. So, of course, he omits all of the philology that we did already address. I'm not a philologist. I had a philologist address the work. Now, you know, and we also had another philologist, Anna Partington, and I read her quote last week, and her quote was in both books. My book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, as well as my book, The Holy Mushroom, and of course, he omitted that as well. And, you know, he said that I went to Cal State Northridge specifically to get all the quotes on this. Actually, that was most of the research that we did at Cal State Northridge for those 3 days was specifically on astrotheology. It was for one research topic. I already showed you a big box down here of stuff I have. You know, what he's doing is he's conflating topics and issues and discussions and then merging them into one and then going, ha, 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 you know, so that he can look, you know, clever and intelligent. But, you know, that wasn't the only time. That was specifically about astrotheology. And we did also go through and pull up, you know, maybe a dozen or half a dozen academic articles that Allegra had published on the Dead Sea Scrolls that weren't really related to the research, but we wanted to have them archived, and we put those up on the John Allegra website. So, you know, he's confusing and conflating many ideas, and he apparently doesn't even know, you know, the premise of my book. He didn't read it all the way through and get what the arguments were or anything. He just kind of cherry-picked, or maybe he used, you know, like Amazon online search to go through the book. Like, you know, for instance, there was an image that I caught him attacking towards the back of the book, and all of his attacks were about the back of the book. He didn't address any of the primary documentation. The entire front of the book is all primary documentation, all original research that we did. He didn't address any of it.
He skipped right to the back of the book. 115.
He skipped straight forward to page 115, and then he attacked, you know, this image talking about how it's blue, you know, this image here, if for those who can see it on the camera, and how it's blue. But he omits that this whole section here is about both psilocybe and amanita mushrooms. And right here, just four pages before that, we even have the different growth cycles of both mushrooms listed there. But we talk throughout this section about how the mushrooms were often amalgamated and even with trees and other plants to hide, you know, what they were. You know, it's not much of a mystery religion if you just put it right out there and make it as plain as day for everybody to get. But, you know, this image of the salamander, and what, you know, he attacks me because I had pulled this, and myself and others had pulled this from Chris Bennett, and he thought that it was an alchemical text when it was actually a Christian bestiary. But one thing that Tom Hatzis doesn't get, and I still haven't had the time to check if it was a Christian bestiary, but if he's correct, that's actually more support for our work. And you can see on there that this is very similar to the Adam and Eve story, and many of the Adam and Eve pictures even have a lizard more than a snake in the depictions there. And you know, he says that
what does the word bestiary mean?
It's a book of beasts and mythological creatures and things like that, right? And so what he says, you know, Tom Hatzis must think that this story is literal, because, you know, he argues that salamanders can't burn, and that, you know, the poison from the salamander entered the tree, and that the guy is eating poison fruit. He doesn't make the connection that poison and drugs were basically considered the same back then. In ancient Greece, and I interviewed Dr. David Hillman on my show about this a couple of years ago, but in ancient Greece, the only difference between, you know, between the drug and a poison was dosage. Like, it was common for people to get high on things like hemlock, which is you know, of course, a poison, and just you increase the dosage a little bit and it kills you. But at a low dose, it has an intoxicating effect. So, but he actually apparently thinks that the salamander literally doesn't die in a fire. And I guarantee you, if you take a salamander and you put it in a fire, it's going to die. You know, and so he thinks that the magical poison, he takes this all as literal instead of allegory. You know, and so here we have the salamander on this side climbing up the tree. And right here, from an ancient Italian text, we have the serpent climbing up what looks very much like a psilocybe mushroom. You know, so these are very similar themes here. And here's another one right here. And this is the plain coral fresco from France. And it's almost the identical theme. So what he's doing is he's not taking the theme as a whole. And like I said, if it's a Christian bestiary, then it's even more support for our work. And there's another one right there with the mushroom trees and everything. And there's even, in this one, in the cap of that mushroom, there are even smaller mushrooms. Now, there was one image here that he attacked. He did attack two images, I did check. And, you know, what he's not understanding is that all of this stuff is allegory. Now, he attacks on page 137, the Last Judgment from the Holcomb Bible, which is 1320 to 1330. And it says, you know, and I could have been a little more clear on this, and he is right in some aspect, which I'll clarify here. I could have put more of this information in the book on this section, but the wounded Christ sits flanked by two angels with the instruments of the passion. The angel on the left stares at three distinct mushrooms that he holds in his hands. Okay, so here's this image right here, and you can see this whole thing going on here. Now, I've already shown several of the Adam and Eve mushroom trees. And the, you know, we have this constant mushroom allegory. Like, look at this one. This one's from Russia, and we can actually see them sitting around a table with Amanita spotted, like, chalices sitting there on the table, you know, with a bowl being sacrificed down in the front, Mithra style. So, you know, all of these other symbols are omitted, and then what he does is he nitpicks this one thing. But if we get into the let me just find that real quick. If we get into the passion, and let me just pull up my citations on that here real quick.
Also, just remember that because we're on radio, the audience can't see these images. So okay. Give a brief description as you're showing them.
Okay, right, okay. Well, and maybe we can include some of the images there. But, you know, it's basically, it's a picture that looks very much like Archangel, and I think it was Michael I just read, holding up three mushrooms. Now, he attacks me for this, and he says, these are the instruments of the passion. Now, let's go back and let's look at what are the instruments of the passion. Now, in my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, we covered most of these symbols. Now, what we have is the chalice, which I just showed you, a red and white spotted one that looks like the mushroom. The hammer, Thor's hammer, related to lightning. This is very often, by very many mythologists, been related to psychedelic experience. The ladder, climbing to the heavens. The serpent enwrapped tree that is also the caduceus, the symbol of drugs. The cross and spear, the cross has been argued as that as well. The spear, in some instances, has both the sun and moon, as we show in this book, have, and this is my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, both the sun and moon have been argued as the mushroom for the different growth stages, and this can be read in Ruck's book, which he says he supports, in Allegro's work, etc. You know, but it's interesting that he, you know, attacks Allegro and then says he's for Ruck. You know, when Ruck has wrote extensive work showing a lot of Allegro's work is in fact correct. But we also have a vassal. Oh, here's a good one: the purple robe or the scarlet robe, right? Well, what, you know, if we look at the top of a bright red and white spotted Amanita muscaria, you know, we have this same sort of color and theme going on here. And then we have a vassal, the pincers to remove the nails, which I think is an interesting comment. Maybe, you know, in my interpretation, that would probably be something for removing the mushrooms and things like this. Like in Europe, when they would pick things like, mandrake, they would actually tie a dog around the plant and then have the dog drag it out so that the mythical shrieks from the plant wouldn't kill anyone in ear sight. Lanterns and torches we covered in Astrotheology and Shamanism related to mushrooms. Swords, we covered that related to mushrooms. You know, and in your interview with him, he claimed to have read my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, but how did he skip over all of these key points that are the instruments of the passion that we covered in this book? You know, and when I look at all of the images of the nails and other things, I mean, they look so distinctly like psilocybe-type mushrooms. And when you look at all of the other instruments of the Passion, you know, and we, you know, if we take these stories literal, we're gonna miss the point. If we take these as ancient mystery initiations and drug cults and things, which there's a lot of evidence that there is, then what we're arguing makes sense. But if you take things out of context and misconstrue them and what we're presenting, then, you know, you can make up a hokey argument to attack all of our work. But, you know, he goes on, he attacks, you know, the word liberal, and the word liberal meaning, you know, coming from the word ever to be free, and says, you know, if I knew Latin, I would have take that all the way back. Well, we're talking about, you know, the first primary origin of the word liberal in English to the, you know, primary Latin, which is free, and it goes back to book. So where do books come from? He attacks me for not going back to bark. It's like saying, you know, you're not going back to the word, you know, to papyrus when you talk about the word paper. Bark is where we get paper, is where books are made from. You know, that was the whole argument, was we're talking about the books were in the libraries. And just because, you know, the ancients, you know, wrote things down that they made from bark on paper, papyrus, etc., you know, it doesn't negate the point. So, you know, he's creating a false argument. But interestingly, some of the barks that were used, the inner barks of plants, wood usually containing a large portion of woody fibrous cells, including, especially as that of hemp, etc. So I found that citation quite interesting there. But, you know, there's just so many dozens of these little things that he attacked me for. He attacks me for pronouncing the word trivium in English, which we talked about on Friday, and anybody can look this up in any dictionary. It is pronounced trivium in English. We're not sitting here speaking in Latin, so we don't have any need to say every single word that we're using in Latin. So it is trivium in English. Anyone can look that up. There's no reason to create a ridiculous attack about that. He goes on in his attack against me to talk about Dr. Robert Price. He claims that, well, hold off.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that.
That's the same spot as last time.
Yeah. All right. In the end, everything comes back to the beginning. And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Hopefully it won't take 1,000 years where fact turns into legend and legend turns into myth. Back in a minute.
Been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles, but I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual. I am not yet credible, so until I can say I'm credible, I'll
welcome
say that
back,
I'm incredible, respectable, and professional.
Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about being an edible extraterrestrial, right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, broadcasting live from terrestrial radio stations around the world. Do not try to eat them, okay? The people who work at these stations work very hard, and they are not edible terrestrial radio. Now, we were doing over the break, you know, I thought it'd be funny. I like to laugh at the New World Order's jokes. You know how they play jokes on us and stuff like that, and they sit back like, jet fuel, that's a good one. In the case of 9/11. And I was just thinking, you know, how we've got all these boy bands and they're like brainwashing all the kids and getting all the girls like clustered around and stuff like that, like Boys to Men or Westlife or whatever. And, you know, I was just thinking I should start a boy band, you know, facts to myth. And I reckon that'd be great. You know, you could be up in front of the stage with all these prepubescent girls brainwashing them. And they're as they're all chanting, facts to myth, facts to myth. I'm not planning on seriously doing this, of course, but I have the philosophy that if an evil scumbag is making you the butt of the joke, I think if you laugh too, then you rob them of their power over that joke.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong. Jan Irvin's my very special guest. Welcome back.
Thanks.
If you would continue your point that you
sure,
were
well,
getting
you know,
onto after the...
It's pretty funny because twice now, right when we got to discussing Robert Price, the commercial music started up, right? So, you know, this time we'll get into it right at the beginning here. But, you know, he attacks me for citing Robert Price in there. Robert Price, it actually pulled his negative review of Acharya S.'s first book, The Christ Conspiracy. Apparently, Tom Hatzis didn't know that Acharya and Dr. Robert Price had worked together for a time. But, you know, in Robert Price's last review of her most recent book, and she's got five on all of this, and, you know, people that attack the first book, they forget that she's got four others that, you know, you have to take all the research as a whole on this. And, in fact, I supplied some of the original primary citations to, like, Church Father Epiphanius that supports all of that. But here's a quote from Robert Price. He says, "I find myself in full agreement with Acharya S. D.M. Murdoch. We assert that Christianity constitutes Gnosticism, historicized and Judaized, likewise representing a synthesis of Egyptian, Jewish, and Greek religion and mythology, amongst others, including Buddhism, via King Asoka's missionaries from around the known world. Christianity is largely the product of Egyptian religion being Judaized and historicized." Robert Price. So does that sound like he's totally against everything that she's ever written that, you know, Tom Hatzis tried to, you know, portray the other day, misrepresenting Robert Price and slandering all of that? So, you know, and another interesting thing, I'm not sure if Tom was discussing my book, The Holy Mushroom, or my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, but what he says in there in his interview with you is that my book had five references in the bibliography. So just so you can see this, here's page one of the bibliography, page two, page three, page four, and page five. It's actually 71 references there. So that's a whole lot more than five. I don't know why he needs to lie about that. But if he was talking about my book, A&S, the bibliography there actually has 300 citations, or almost 300. And then it's got, 500 and something footnotes in it as well. So, you know, 300, how does he confuse 300 with 5? How does he confuse 500 and some odd citations with 5? And many, many dozens of those are to primary citations like the Church Father Epiphanius text that I mentioned just a minute ago. So, I mean, you know, did he represent anything accurately? What is his agenda? Is he, you know, is he working with Johnny Enoch and these guys just to go pump out stuff? Is he a scion? You know, what the heck is going on there? I don't know. But he has no interest in being honest. He has no interest in admitting that I rebutted him back in February, you know, wasting all this time with this, you know, with this nonsense and all this hoopla that he wants to create. Usually I wouldn't even address this kind of stuff. You know, and it's funny, is up on your Skype thing earlier today, you had some, you know, a quote that was kind of pertinent to that too. I should have grabbed it. But you know, so he's always, his whole attack about the salamander and, you know, how bad a researcher I am, you know, back in the 2006, 2007, 2008, you know, you couldn't just upload an image and search the whole internet and figure out where the image came from, etc. Like Chris Bennett had found that image. We had actually spent a long time tracking it down, so I'm glad that he found that it's a Christian bestiary text, because it gives us much more support for the work. But let me see. I mean, you know, he goes on about, he talks about he claims all Latin, all of the alchemy stuff out there is in Latin, that none of it's been translated into English, you know, and then he, all of a sudden, he switches to quote unquote, well, not this one, I translated it. Okay, so, you know, he goes from all, I couldn't have studied any of this stuff, to this one text because he translated it. Again, you know, changing the point, but he does appeal to popularity about how many academics agree or disagree, regardless of whether or not they've studied the work and the details of the research. If their own agendas are involved in the research, such as me exposing Wasson and all of these scholars who have their last 55 years of their life invested in Wasson and him being a real guy when it turns out that he wasn't, right? So,
yeah, well, I found it very interesting is that kind of appeal to popularity is really rampant throughout society. Even last night on Facebook, I had somebody comment on my status saying, oh, your number of friends has gone down on Facebook lately, therefore you don't have any credibility at all.
Right,
and then I replied to him and said, well, you know, you're absolutely right, because one's credibility is only determined by how much friends they have, right?
On Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, that's like Tom Hatzis and these guys. They don't focus on each point of the research. Instead, they cherry pick two things out of an entire book and then nitpick on these two things. You know, so, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Why ignore all of the primary evidence and documentation that debunked all of his claims, in fact, regarding Allegro and all of the statements against him and his work? Why ignore all of that and then just focus on these two images, excuse me, unless he's got an agenda there, you know, or just completely, you know, out of his mind? I don't know what's the case. I'm not trying to name call or attack the guy or call him a coward or anything, but I mean, you know, there's definitely some cognitive dissonance in there and some serious lack of critical thinking.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because when you and I've experienced this myself, maybe you have too, when somebody's kind of coming up with an idea that you inherently disagree with or whatever, even if you're wrong, you start to come up and try and find anything you can, any tiny little thing, even no matter how wrong it is, in order to throw it at you and just go, like,
throw the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah.
Right. See, you know, and they just literally, they will throw everything at you. They will never go point by point through the research, which I would love. And then what they'll do is they'll criticize you for not taking their feedback about your work that they never read. And they're like, you know, you won't take other people's feedback and points. You're not open-minded. You're an a-hole. You're this and you're that. And it's like, well, you know, if you would actually read my work first before you gave me all of these unfounded opinions that aren't about anything that I wrote, then maybe we could sit down and have an intelligent conversation about it. But you're making up lies and wild assumptions out of pure ignorance about things that I never said or wrote or claimed or anything. And then they attack me for not listening to their nonsense that they, you know, channeled from your anus.
That's happened a couple of times again on Facebook, where people will come on and say you're a moron and F you and just abuse, and then you block them, and then you see them going on and complaining on different forums how Vinny Eastwood doesn't care about free speech because I blocked them for giving me nothing but abuse and tirades.
Right. Exactly. You know, and going back to his attack on me on philology, and I read this last week regarding Anna Partington. I just want to read it again so people can hear this. But his whole attack on philology, missing that Carl Ruck and I together published a 15-page addendum, all philology, in the back of the Sacred Mushroom of the Cross 40th Anniversary Edition that was published in 2009. I don't know how he missed that, but it is from Professor Ruck. And then Anna Partington, who is a well-known Sumerian expert, says, this is from ANS, and my intro leading into her quote, since the time Allegro published The Sacred Mushroom of the Cross, much new research in the area of fertility cults and their relationship to entheogens, and especially mushrooms, has surfaced. Finding a Sumerian philologist who possesses a knowledge of entheogens and fertility cults is next to impossible. However, during our research, we learned of one highly credited Sumerian philologist, Anna Partington. Partington is a former associate of Allegro, who also possesses a deep understanding of entheogens and fertility cults. Though not in complete support of his views, this is what she had to say regarding Allegro. Quote, most people come to the field of Sumerian studies with a background in several early Eastern Mideastern languages. Although John was of a previous generation, he was, in common with most Orientalists, perfectly well equipped. And, you know, when they say Orientalists, basically anything that's east of Greece is considered the Orient. So I've actually had people attack me, well, Allegro was an Orient. He wasn't qualified to study Hebrew and all of this stuff. But that, you know, the Orient includes anything east of Greece. So we got to be clear on that. Let's see. Orientalists perfectly well equipped to deal with cuneiform languages. He found comparative linguistic study especially interesting. But early in his career, the finding of the scrolls by the Dead Sea led him to specialize in the translation of these Hebrew and Aramaic documents. She goes on anyway. We'll finish the rest of the quote when we get back.
Yeah, and also when we get back, there's a number of criticisms of me based on that interview that I would actually like you to go into and pull me up on after the break, because I think it's like basically I want to really just be honest and say that I messed up, you know, with that thing, didn't do my the grammar and during the interview didn't apply the trivium as it should have done, and so on and so forth. We want to actually go in those details and learn a little bit about how kind of lazy and unthinking I can be sometimes. We'll be right back, sure. Ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
Imminent pollution, gathering dust particles, funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation too fed. Check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about solidarity. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. Jan, I'd like you to elaborate, if you will, because I know that you've got a lot of breakdowns of what Tom Hantz has said that was wrong in the interview and how he behaved. And pointing that out, and I also wanted you to balance that out by pointing out my failures in the interview as well, because I need to basically learn something. Well, you know, so I don't do it again.
Well, a really good one that he used on you was when somebody brought up the flat Earth bits, and he said it was just a shibboleth, which was an interesting comment from him, but. You know, shibboleth is a word, sound, or custom that a person unfamiliar with its significance may not pronounce or perform correctly, blah, blah, blah. But regarding the whole flat Earth thing, what he did was in the middle of his attack on you, he switched the meaning of the word, and I'm just trying to find it here, more of my citations here. But, okay, so, you know, what we did is in our book, we presented everything, what we were saying about the flat Earth theory. So let me read that first, and then we can break down his argument about it. And he omitted most of what we wrote about this, and he just read one little quote out of context, okay? Ancient pagan religions in the Mediterranean area, and throughout the Middle East taught that the universe was quite tiny. These included the religions of ancient Europe, ancient Egypt, Babylon, Canaan, etc. The earth was often thought of as flat, like a dinner plate. Mountains around the edges held up a rigid metallic dome which formed the sky. The gods and angels pushed the sun and moon and planets across the dome of the sky on a daily basis. God sits in his throne in heaven, which lies above the great dome or canopy. Doors or windows of the dome could be opened through which water, fire, and in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, brimstone could be poured. This is the view of the universe that writers of the Bible appear to have adopted from these pagan religions if one interprets their writing literally. The problem came after Aristotle suggested that the earth is a sphere. Many members of the clergy could not accept that as truth. There are a number of implications in the Bible that it is the sun that moves, not the earth. And also, in a couple pages later, we say our ancestors lacked the technology that we provide ourselves on today. For them, it made sense that the Earth was like the center of the universe. From as high up on any mountain as one could climb, the Earth appeared to be as flat as a chessboard. So, see, that's what he read and then took it all out of context. Well, if there's mountains, it's not flat. But what he's doing is he uses an equivocation on you to trick you right there, because we're talking about the flat earth theory and the biblical references, and he calls it a shibboleth, and then he switches it to, well, there's mountains, so the earth couldn't be flat. That's ridiculous. You see, they're two entirely different discussions and conversations. So what he did was he literally tracked you off onto another conversation, and right then you just sat quiet. You actually caught it. You were just like, huh? But you sat quiet. You didn't call him out for it, but I could tell that you caught it.
Yeah. What was going through my mind was, hold on a second, flat earth means that, you know, people thought that they would sail to India and accidentally fall and off the side of it. Not that the whole thing is like a dinner plate.
Without mountains and stuff. So what he did was he tricked you right in the middle of the argument, using this as an attack against me, right? And so then he goes on, and we talked about this on Friday a little bit, but he attacks me for Godfrey Driver, et cetera, and these scholars that published their attack. I think it was in the London Times or something like that, the same week that Allegra published his book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. Now, in the back of The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, from page 207 to page 349.
While we're waiting there, because I also wanted to know precisely what should I have actually done in that instance with the flat earth reference.
Well,
I should have just called them on it.
Those are two different topics. You know, we're not discussing if the ancients believed that mountains existed, or if, you know, we're talking about if they thought that they would go off the end of the earth, right? You know, when they were out at sea or whatever. But, you know, you would just have to point it out to him that those are two entirely different subjects, and that that's not entirely honest for him to attack, you know, somebody for. But obviously his whole agenda was to get you to, you know, allow him to come on so that he could just spew his propaganda for an hour and then, you know, go away laughing, thinking that he's, you know, the great superhero scholar, you know. And as it's funny, speaking of the scholar issue, and then I'll get back to the quotes in Allegra's book, but the scholar issue is he, you know, what he did was, he didn't, you know, when he talks about Carl Ruck and this great response that Carl supposedly sent him about his scholarship on this one image, he didn't debunk anything but one image. Apparently, he believes that if there's one single error in a book, then it somehow debunks every single primary quote citation in there, even if it doesn't actually, you know, even if it's a very minor detail of the work. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But what he didn't admit was, in his first email to me, it was all name calling and attacks. And then he turns around and says, you know, see, Carl Ruck sent me this great email. What a scholar I am. And here is Jan Irvin's email. Well, I'm just looking for his email here that he sent me, the first one. So here it is. He says, looks like someone got caught red-handed making an argument from ignorance. And then he links his article. And he says, there's no place to hide anymore. You should have learned Latin like I suggested instead of, you know, and I never heard from this guy before, instead of your overuse of argumentum ad ignorantium, because you are about to look really foolish. See Appendix 2 and answer my questions. I will not respond otherwise. Checkmate, amateur. That was his first message to me. And then he says, you know, and then he reads to you my response.
Can I just interject here?
Hold on. But do you get that he read to you my response and Carl's response and then tried to attack me while omitting his own actions in the whole thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, if you've got a bad demeanor, right, and you say things in a really bad way, when you tell that story to other people, you omit the bad things that you said, only keep in the actual things that you wanted to say, and then try and do the exact same thing to the other person and only try and remember the bad things that they said and forget about all the good
things. That's exactly. And here's another really good one that he sent to me like a couple of months ago or a month ago or so, maybe April, I forget. I probably have it here somewhere, but he says, hey, Jan, so I was thinking, I was talking to the publisher or to the publishing house lawyers about my legal right to call you a fraud in my forthcoming book that demolishes your idiotic ideas. The lawyers said that it depends on if you knew at the time that you were full of shit or wholly ignorant of how dumb you truly are. My question, are you aware of the fact that you are a fraud, or are you just stupid? I ask because legally, I can't call you a fraud or a charlatan in my book if you truly are ignorant of how stupid you are. If you are unaware of how subpar your quote-unquote research is, then I can call you a fraud all day and night. If you're not, I have to settle on words like historically inept and stupid. So I leave the decision to you. When my book comes out next year, do you want the chapter devoted to you to be titled, quote, Jan Ervin, charlatan, or, quote, Jan Ervin, idiot? Please let me know ASAP. Oh, and have a great day. Once my book comes out and everyone sees how dishonest or stupid, remember, it's your choice. You are. You won't have too many more good days. Sincerely, Thomas Alexander Hatzis, the man who has made a laughingstock out of you in real academic circles. And then, you know, closing with an appeal to authority there, you know, and I mean, you know, here's my response to him. Resorting to ad hominem attacks rather than dealing with each specific point in the research on its own merit by going one by one is really a sign of one's own mental bankruptcy and lack of mental cognizance and inability to deal with the facts. This is why they name call like little children on the playground. Fraud, charlatan, idiot, dishonest, stupid, full of shit, dumb. Excuse me, did I just read all of those out loud? I'm so sorry.
And you also did one earlier as well. But uh-oh. Keep going.
Okay.
Normally we use word replacement therapy.
These are quotes.
Like the F word becomes frack. The S word becomes
shiite. And these are specific quotes, and I am reading something and quoting from it. So terms one uses to attack the man when one feels threatened and intellectually incapable of dealing with the facts and citations presented. Another trick of mental deficits is to not examine the entire argument as a whole, to cherry pick out a single item, or to cherry pick out an item to attack, known as a straw man argument, and take it out of context. How you want to present yourself is really up to you. Make sure that you take nothing out of context, which of course he did, and don't misquote anything, which of course he did, as this is when the person you're attacking and name-calling at will get to take every penny from your work. If you want to sound like an intelligent human being, then you'd simply have to deal with each citation point by point in the work as a whole, rather than resorting to adolescent idiocy such as name-calling. Singling out a single image and ignoring every other bit of research presented and then name-calling is not a sound or intelligent way to approach things. But how one whose agenda-driven protects his beliefs. Luckily, only your own reputation is on the line and your non-existent publishers. And then there was another thing here. Let me see if I can find that. But, you know, I actually got an email from a former friend of associate of his. Just, you know, right before that, let me see if I can find that. Here we go.
Basically calling Tom a mental case of some kind, isn't it?
Right. So this is from February 14, 2013, and this is Tenostic Media. Just wanted Jan to know that an ex-tutor of my brother's is mentally unstable and bashing Jan on Facebook, complete with posting names and people he claims to have emailed him, calling him names and insulting him. Be careful, because Tom, who is Agrippa Weyer on Facebook, is disturbed and should not be worked with on any projects.
Mm. And who was that email sent by?
It was somebody that called themselves Indra and said that their brother was tutored by Tom Hatzis previously. You know, okay. So, you know, I get this warning.
It's a sibling of a former student of Tom's.
Okay. Right. And so, you know, what we have here, though, and, you know, also this guy pointed out to me that Tom was supposedly challenging me to a debate that he never challenged me to. Like, supposedly he told everybody else about it, but never me. Right. You know, I just read you his first email and stuff. There's no challenge to a debate there or anything. And then I sent him
Perhaps he thought that if he made those challenges on public forums, that you would
show up and then he could go,
that you would be following his posts and things of that. Now, you got better work to do, you know.
Sure.
If you want to challenge me to something, just challenge me, bro, because you don't need to challenge anybody else because nobody else is going to be at the debate, are they?
So yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, in February, on February 16th at 12:44 p.m., I sent him a 6-page rebuttal of his article that he entirely omitted every bit of from your show,
which I attempted to read out in my show, but didn't quite get through.
Right. You know, and I don't know if you read that or the other one, but there was one that was sent from February and then one that I wrote right then that day. But, you know, it starts out, you know, I've read your fallacy filled and conflated paper that intentionally focuses on a single image or a single point and omits the rest of the research provided to make your case. Is that the one that you read?
I think I actually have read both of them. The other okay, one, yeah, that one that I read on
this,
air, I'd read it
letter
previously.
This letter was only posted on your wall and not on mine. So if you only read what was on mine, you missed this one.
No, I did both.
Okay, got it. Okay. So, yeah, and then we go into, you know, Acharya S., Robert Price's own statements. Then he makes up another lie about Robert Price's statements on that, you know. What he does is he says that ancient Christian mushroom cult idea. And in this book, I very specifically argue against the ancient mushroom cult idea because of how widespread it was. So, again, taking my work out of context and, you know, distorting all of that. Shermer's Babylonian detection kit, which is an appeal to ridicule. You know, he doesn't just talking about, you know, Charya's ideas have been denounced. Which ones? By whom? Every single one? Really? Prove it. The onus of proof falls on you. I mean, how would they debunk primary texts like, you know, Church Father Epiphanius' text that I published in this book that I gave to Acharya? You know, I mean, how are they going to just debunk on a whim a 4th century primary Christian text? I mean, you don't just debunk something just because you say so. You know, it's not that, you know, quite that easy. So, you know, right here, and you can see this, and maybe if you put out a video version, your audience will too, but there's the text to Epiphanius right there, you know, and this is a 4th century text where he's specifically discussing all of the ties between astrotheology and Christianity.
Could you say for the audience just exactly what book and what page that's on?
Oh, boy, and I just set it down. So this is my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, and it is page. And this citation was very hard to find. I found it first in a German book, and then we had to track down the original in the Latin, which Acharya found. And then we found an English translation that was, I'll just read you what Robert Stowe Mead said in his book, Thrice Great Hermes, from 1906.
We've only got 30 seconds. We've only got 30
okay,
seconds.
And this is from page 21 in my book, Astrotheology. And here it will be of interest to turn to a curious statement of Epiphanius. It is missing in all editions of this father prior to that of Dendorf from Leipzig, 1859, Leipzig University, which was based on the very early 10th century Codex Marcanius 125, all previous editions being printed from a severely censored and bowdlerized 14th century manuscript. And so, you know, I published this whole document in that book. I mean, all of this stuff is omitted. You know, you can't debunk somebody by ignoring their work. You go point by point. You know, they say, oh, this one thing is an error, so therefore all of their work is wrong. And this is just, you know, not critical thinking. It's delusion.
That happens to me all the time. I'll try and explain something about vaccines, and I'll be, like, slightly incorrect or something, and therefore vaccines are safe because I was incorrect right. about one thing that was dangerous right. that incidentally wasn't that dangerous. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
I got some so-called friends. Smile right to my face. All when my back is turned. They like to bury me without a trace. Oh no, no. Oh no, no. There's only one thing I need to know.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure, 3 till 5 p.m. Pacific time for those of you on the irradiated California coastline near Bohemia Grove, where there's lots of nasty things that go on there behind the scenes with gay porn stars and whatnot, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah, that's the... I can just imagine this for a moment, ladies and gentlemen. Have you ever seen or heard of like real debauched sex tapes being released about celebrities or something like this? Imagine for a moment. Just imagine. I'm not saying that this is true, but imagine that every single one of the really high-powered world leaders who all go to Bohemian Grove have just as many terrible things that could be released about them if they were to ever step out of line and stop spreading their BS propaganda and the agenda. Just imagine that for a moment. Then you start to realize how our society is run, I think, with a little bit of imagination, which Einstein, he said, is more important than knowledge, didn't he?
Yeah, well, let's not get into how he stole half of his stuff from the U.S. Patent Office, et cetera, and John Bjorkness' work.
Well, I guess he imagined stealing knowledge is also beneficial to oneself.
Sure. So anyway, let's dive into this because there's a few more key points that I want to touch on here before I forget. Let's see. He attacks my book, The Holy Mushroom. He omits that Ruck's endorsement is on the back cover of the book. And that says John Allegra's revelation of the sacramental role in the sacred mushroom in the ancient religion spanned the agrarian region from Mesopotamia to the Near East was immediately and unfairly rejected by a chorus of scholars less competent than him. But continuing research into early Christianity and the mystery religions of the Greco-Roman world and their perpetuation in alchemy and European folkloric traditions has vindicated the correctness of his discovery. So, I mean, this is right on the back cover of my book from Karl Ruck. Why did he omit this? Who knows? And, you know, it's just, wow. So, let's see. And then he goes on, he attacks me for illiteracy in the Dark Ages. I didn't really get that. I mean, you just type in illiteracy in the Dark Ages in Google, and you can see that reading and writing was banned for the serfs for centuries. I mean, you know, seriously, that's why it was called the Dark Ages, because there wasn't literacy and science and all of these things. So whatever, man. I guess he's never opened a history book, doesn't know about the Dark Ages. But anybody who wants to learn about that, just type in illiteracy and the Dark Ages. And also the Catholic Church had had restrictions on reading and writing throughout various times of history.
Yeah. What is the literacy level of current U.S. high school graduates? And are we entering into a new dark age?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that specifically. But, you know, I've done a lot of work with John Taylor Gatto. I had him on my show three times, who exposed a lot of that stuff regarding the whole dumbing down of education, being intentional and everything. And everyone should go out right now. And there's a link to it on GnosticMedia.com. But get John Taylor Gatto's The Ultimate History Lesson. It's a five-hour series or a five-hour interview that my partner Richard Andrew Grove did with Tragedy and Hope, and it's mind-blowing. All the citations are right there for people to check and everything. But let me get to this one also. This is an important one. He attacks me for going on about Godfrey Driver and all these guys that wrote this thing in the London Times I started to mention earlier, attacking Allegro. But this was actually published the same week as Allegro's book. Now, when I went through we were talking about earlier about the citations in the back of Allegra's book, there is 150 pages of notes, as you can see here in the video. That's all just the notes section. Okay, so it took me just going through and getting out the entheogen citations and tracking down all of the original books and everything and checking them, took me over a year. Now, they want us to believe that 14 scholars got the book the same week it was published, read the book, studied all of those citations, interrupting everything else in their world at the same time, by the way, and tracked down, verified his work, and then wrote this article in the Times and debunked him all in 1 week. Well, guess what? You know, it took me a year just to track down, like I said, the primary citations just on entheogens, and Ruck did a lot of the philology work, not for my book, but on his own and in Fungus Redivivus, which I published. And, you know, there is just no way that even a team of 14 people could go through that many. I mean, when you open up the back of the book and you see how dense these notes and everything are, I mean, if you can see that there, you can see all of the foreign languages and everything that are intermixed there, all of the deep citations and stuff that are right there. And it's thick, heavy, dense reading to go through. And it's not something you just do on a weekend and then whip out an article to publish in the newspaper. So my argument is that these guys were, you know, just like Allegro was always at contention, which he brought up in his interview with you. Well, it was not the first time Allegro was attacked. Allegro was always attacked regarding his Dead Sea Scrolls research because he didn't agree with Catholic and Zionist interpretations. And he said, you know, we need to step back and look at this stuff in another way. So he was constantly attacked in the media and on, you know, radio shows and stuff for not toting the official line. And in fact, Allegro published all of his Dead Sea Scrolls translations in 1968, and the rest of the team didn't publish any of them until 1991. So Allegro was the only source of information in all of that time, and all of these other scholars withheld all of this stuff. You know, so of course they're going to be out there attacking Allegro for being the pioneer and being the one to promote this. And not only that, but Wasson and all of his CIA buddies were attempting to keep all of the attention focused on Eastern religion, especially Hinduism and Buddhism, and on Native American shamanism and South American shamanism. They didn't want any focus put on Judeo-Christianity because it put the focus in the wrong direction. And then if you're looking at Judeo-Christianity and John Allegro's work, then suddenly you're, you know, studying MK Ultra through all of the false attacks against his work because of Gordon Wasson. So, you know, there's just no way, and being very familiar with Allegro's work, there's just no way that a team of these guys could have pulled that off in a week and done a thorough job. You know, if it takes one guy a year, you know, 14 guys, it would at least take them several months to do it. And so, let's see, you know, at least a month. And there's just no way. They just, you know, the attack that they published, which I've read and I don't have it in front of me, but it was primarily an attack on the principle of the matter, not the research. Just like, you know, Tom Hatzis is doing on me. He's just attacking me and the idea of these things. He's not actually going point by point through the research and the things presented. So these are these kind of tricks that they use.
Kind of like just sitting there and saying, how dare he?
Right, exactly. You know, and it's like an appeal to ridicule in a way. You know, you're wrong because, and that's their whole argument, right? So, I mean, that's one of the most common arguments that people have is the appeal to ridicule. You're wrong because, ha, ha, ha.
I might start using that. I'm right because,
Right. So, you know, as like I said, he goes on to talk about how Allegro was denounced in the academic world before. And, you know, this is a poisoning the well fallacy. And he doesn't bring up what he was attacked for, the whole situation over the scrolls, how the other scholars suppressed the scrolls until 1991. And they basically cut him out of the picture because he wasn't toting the official line. You know, I've studied all of Allegro's books, and I find him to be one of the most continuously upright and solid scholars who I haven't, you know, in the 20 years I've studied him, I haven't found him intentionally fudging anything. I've found, you know, transposed numbers and letters and things like that in his work. But if people sit down and actually take the time to go through his citations, they'll find that they do, in fact, check out. Now, you know, why does Tom omit all of the academics who have endorsed my work or even come on my show endorsing my work? Professor Michael Winkelman published an academic review of my book in the academic journals, very positive review. I've worked with, you know, many dozens of scholars over the year. He brings up a couple that because of their agendas and their association with Wasson, who my work, you know, puts their work in jeopardy, he then uses them to attack me. You know, and then he also attacks like John Rush and these other guys, but he doesn't admit that John Rush is a professor as well. Well, here's another academic who agrees with my work, Garrett Kaiser, Robert Forty. You know, I've gotten many, 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 many emails over the years from academics who do, in fact, support the work. So, of course, he has to admit all of them and just focus on the negative. Then he claims that I'm all mystified by all this stuff, and it's all regular while distorting and conflating everything I ever said or published. And that I wasn't at all mystified by any of this. Mystify means to befuddle, and it's clear who's the one who is, you know, befuddled here. And let's see, you know, the whole Latin liber thing going to bark is just silly, like I already told you earlier. We read that quote, and the word, it goes back to like 20 different languages, but it's irrelevant that you know, that the paper or the book comes from bark. Of course it does. We're not going back to the origin of papermaking. The point was that, in fact, the word liberal does come from of or befitting the free. And yes, of course, that's because of the book education. And if you want to go back further than that, yes, you can see that it was tree bark. Yay. So congratulations to him on that one. Let's see. You know, originally in his article, he was citing my interview with Joe Rogan to attack me, which I thought was really funny for a scholar, considering I've published all of this work, you know, and he attacks a comedian's interview with me that just silly stuff. I already talked about the inflammatory wording that he uses of Christian mushroom cult when I intentionally said that I wasn't for that in my book, Total Distortion. We talked about the poisons already. And how ancient cultures thought, you know, that it was all about dosage. And I've had actually, now that I think of Dan Hillman, and then there was one other, or David Hillman, there was one other book that we did on this. Oh, boy, you know, there's just so much stuff in here. I got a kick out of his comments that he could, you know, relate it to another plant and everything. But obviously, this is all based on a straw man argument and misrepresenting all of our work, as he's repeatedly proved himself doing here today. And, you know, I talk about the caduceus in my original email to him back in February, the caduceus, you know, and I sent him all the stuff. We covered, you know, a half a dozen or a dozen pages in my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, on the origin of the caduceus. Caduceus is the symbol for modern medicine. Today, one cannot practice medicine without the authority of this symbol. Chiropractors and EMTs, emergency medical technicians, for example, are often represented by the staff of Asclepius, the symbol of one serpent on the staff, while modern medical doctors symbol has two serpents. Those represented with one serpent on the staff cannot administer drugs to people, while those with two serpents may. Historically speaking, however, the staff of Asclepius was the original symbol for healing, medicine, and drugs. And I mean, you know, going back to page 115 and that image from the Boldland on, you know, this one that we've been talking about the whole time, the roasting the salamander one. I mean, we're talking about poisons and drugs here. Period. Whether it's one serpent or salamander or snake or lizard, it has to do with the same, you know, typology, the same concepts, the same ideas. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, is there any particular reference between the snake around the staff being for medical practice and, say, the tree of knowledge or Christianity or the Adam and Eve story, anything like that?
Well, I mean, that's what we certainly argue in ANS. We have a whole section on just that in our book, Astrotheology and Shamanism. We talk about the entire origins of the symbol, and I'm showing you some of the stuff here up on the page. Even the dollar symbol has been suggested to come from it, and it goes back to, you know, the symbol of you know, Mercury and pirates. Let me see, you know, buy now, pay later. Money can be the root of all evil. Blah blah blah. During the course of a year, the average American. Blah. And then let me skip forward. You know, anyway, though, there's a chapter. There's a whole section in here on these symbols, and it's like, you know, page probably 135, 140 forward. There's a whole section in that book on it. I won't go into too much detail on it here. I don't remember half of it because it's a book I wrote almost a decade ago, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's understandable. People come up to me and they say, "Hey, Vinny, you see this one thing on this one show," and I forget what this is. Dude, I've done like a couple of hundred shows a year. I can't remember all, and there's like hours of talking within each of them. If I was to remember that much, I would be a superhuman computer, which is incidentally why I have a computer, to have all these things on archives.
Let's see here. Oh, you know, we go on about the caduceus here. I'll read this. This is a good one. It's important to know that the symbol of the caduceus, the symbol of drugs, is the same today as it was thousands of years ago. We find the same symbol representing drugs in the pharmacopoeia in nearly every society on Earth, whether it was Native Americans, the South Americans, Africans, Egyptians, the Middle East, in Asia, or in Europe. The symbol of drugs was ubiquitous, often when the caduceus itself was not represented. Two cornucopias would take its place. These horns of plenty represent the entire bounty of plants. On one side, there are the plants that are harvested and consumed as food. And on the other side are the plants that are used as medicine and for spiritual purposes. Around the outer side, it says, Virtutis fortuna comes. Fortune is the companion of bravery. For further reading on the cornucopia pharmacy, or a.k.a. the pharmacopoeia, we highly recommend Dale Pindell's book. You know, so, and then snake poison was not necessarily considered poisonous. There are reports of snake venom producing pleasant visionary experiences as well, snake venom, etc. You know, so this is, you know, these, there's a whole overlap between poisons and these things that, you know, that this guy Tom completely overlooked and misrepresented, which of course I've covered in great detail on my show as well.
Many things can be poisonous and also be non-lethal and in some cases beneficial, but you know, the one thing that I've seen that can give you some kind of benefit that can't kill you is weed and vitamin C. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinny Usage Show Talk. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show. It's the final segment here with Jan Irvin today. Now, Jan, you had one more point to cover before we can just say, all right, we've tied this little puppy with a neat little bow in a nice little package, and we'll just and we'll put it on the shelf, and then people will now have both sides of the story, the fallacious side of the story and the reality side of the story, and it'll all be clear.
Well, I think so. You know, one other point that he made about the whole argument, and for some reason, you know, again, he claimed to have read my book, but I don't understand how he could miss all of these citations that were in the book, like from Robert Graves. And I was just looking for the page here. But and Robert Graves says that when he was in Israel or in Palestine in the 1950s that he saw Amanita muscaria growing there, and this was all cited in the book. So, you know, I don't know why he, you know, it's the material on Robert Graves starts on page 60, and it's all his primary citations right there. You know, I was just seeing if I could find this this specific reference here and read it to the audience here, but you know, it's all in there. Right there, you know, also, from page 60 forward. So, but Robert Graves is talking about how he himself found the Amanita growing in Palestine in the 1950s. But not only that, but we're talking about a religion from 2,000 years ago. And 2,000 years ago, there was something in the region, and these things were very often traded, which we discussed in ANS. But that thing in the region at the time was this thing called the Cedars of Lebanon. It was a massive forest that stretched through Lebanon at the time, and it would have made a fantastic host for these types of mushrooms. So, you know, we can't look at a desert that sits there today and say, see, it's not there, it's a desert, you know, when 2,000 years ago during the time that we're discussing, it was, in fact, a lush green forest. So why he omitted those two things that were in the book under, you know, the Robert Graves citations, I don't know, but it just fits with more of the, you know, distortions and lies that he committed against my work.
Mm. Now, I'd like to also take some callers as well. So we've thrown the lines open, ladies and gentlemen. So if you want to call in and comment on this, this is your one and only chance. You will probably only be able to take one or two callers. The number is 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. 25. What Jan Irvin's work has meant for you, the trivium, and also the attacks upon him, and of course the defense against these attacks that we've aired today, how you feel about all of this. So 218-339-8525. And in the event that nobody calls in, me and Jan are just going to yank about stuff. It's not going to be that difficult, I don't think. Now, I also wanted to say that I want to admit some of my faults here, because I have I've prioritized getting quantity over quality with this show to a certain extent. Doing five shows a week, sometimes between 5 and 10 guests, means that the ability that I have to reference and check these guests out before they come on and precisely what they're going to be talking about, whether or not it's 100% true, wasn't really part of my repertoire. And now, since this incident, I'm going to actually start making it that. because I realized
now they're going to hold you to it, dude.
Yeah. Well, I just realized something, that now I'm responsible for things that other people say on my show, unless I call out a disclaimer before the show starts that the views and opinions expressed by the guests.
Right. Exactly. And you can't, you know, there's no way that anybody can be 100%, you know, correct all the time. I mean, but what we have to do is process the fallacies out, check things, and we can get, you know, very close and just allow any new information in should it come in the future. And then we have a systematic way to go back and check it against the research that we've already done by, you know, simply just going who, what, where, when, why, and how.
And what I found interesting is that the process is rather simple, and maybe it, you know, when you're trying to memorize something, you need to have it repetition, just so that it sticks in your mind.
Right.
And I don't think I had enough of that. Like, I hadn't quite memorized the who, what, when, where, why, and how to the point where you can instantly recall right as the conversations are happening and point out all the fallacies as they're coming at you, kind of thing. Like, it actually takes a little bit of training. This methodology, the Trivium, actually has a training process behind it, doesn't it, Ian?
Yeah, it does.
I've not been through the process.
Well, yeah, you know, we, myself and Richard Grove and a group of us over Tragedy and Hope, we founded, you know, we did a study group for about a year and a half or 2 years where we went through the grammar and the logic and everything. And, you know, just about once a week we did this study group. And then that was a way to kind of force us to, you know, go through and study all of the references and everything. But, you know, I mean, it's a lot of work. It's, you know, it's very rewarding at the end of it all. But, you know, it's a lot of work from the get-go. And, you know, it's just basically reconditioning your mind to, you know, not think with fallacies or with lies. I mean, you know, the ones that we tell ourselves are the worst ones. And it's, you know, you can spend sometimes 5, 10 minutes or even a day maybe researching something and find out the truth of it versus spending a lifetime believing in a lie. And so, you know, what's better, to hold on to this lie for your entire life? What is more time consuming, right? And people will argue all the time that I don't have time to do this, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, you know, blah, 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 I'm not a researcher, et cetera. But, you know, if somebody makes a claim, and, you know, like in my book, there's all of these citations. So if somebody just wanted to check my citations in my Holy Mushroom book, they would go to my book, check the citations, and I've got actually everybody else's claims and primary citations listed in this book right there for people to go through. So then they would just go to these other books, open them up, you know, go on Amazon or whatever, order the books, open them up, and just check and make sure that I didn't quote anything out of context, et cetera. So that's really the, you know, the whole premise of it, and, you know, pretty much as easy as that.
Yeah, well, it's a simple process, isn't it? And I failed in my duty as you know, I never claim to have credibility because that way I can't lose it, kind of thing. That's sort of my philosophy as well. And you just got to be honest, you know. So if you're wrong and somebody comes up with evidence that you're wrong, you have to admit it as quickly as possible and make amends as quickly as possible.
Right.
And this is the very reason why you're on here today. Yeah, because I don't like that. I mean, in most cases, whenever I've gotten into arguments with people over something that I've done, I'm actually usually in the wrong, because otherwise the argument wouldn't start. And all the other times, it's just because somebody misinterpreted what I said, and then I just got to explain, this is what I meant, so on and so forth.
You'll find there's basically, you know, two essential groups of people when it comes down to work that you're putting out. Those who have studied it, and then they'll sit down with you and go point by point, you know, and they'll say, you know, I have this other citation right here that shows that this is an error, you know, and then, but, you know, these points are all correct, so we need to fix this one right here or whatever. Whereas somebody who doesn't study your work, they will give you advice about your work without reading it, telling you what you should have said without reading it, calling you names without reading it, going on and on with all manner of just fallacious nonsense. But they can never stick to any point that you ever actually wrote. So, you know, don't, you know, ignorance comes from choosing to ignore things. And if you choose to ignore things, you know, like I said, you know, instead of, studying it, removing the fallacies and contradictions from your own thoughts, verifying everything, then you come to certainty. You know, and if I'm certain about something, if I know what something says on page 21, I know what it says. You know, and it doesn't matter if somebody comes up and tells me, why do you have to be so certain? It could say something else. You know, it's like, well, I know what it says. Did you read it? I am certain what it says because I have read it. In fact, I wrote that page and I know what I was saying. And, you know, people will sit there and argue with you over what something says or means that they've never read. They won't read your argument. And it's, you know, it's just such a dishonest thing. It's like, if you want to have an intelligent conversation about something, study it, go point by point through it, check everything out, keep the work together as a whole. Don't use a bunch of fallacies and, you know, lies to attack the person. And then we can sit down if you do find anything and we can discuss it. Or even if you didn't find anything, then now we can still discuss it intelligently and say, yeah, you know, we can discuss all of the points of the research and then we can learn and grow from it rather than ignoring it. You know, essentially, and on the on my triviumeducation.com website, if people go there, there's a really good article and I'm just pulling it up right now. It's called Incompetent and Unaware. And it's really important for people to, and it's by David Dunning and Justin Kruger, Unskilled and Unaware of It, How Difficulties in Recognizing One's Own Incompetence Lead to Self-Inflated Assessments. So, you know, what we have here is Tom is a perfect example of this. He doesn't go through things carefully. He takes things out of context. He jumps to page 115, ignoring all the research prior to that. You know, doesn't think through poison, drugs, blah, blah, blah. You know, but if we approach every new subject that we're getting into as if we're incompetent and then work from there, building out the grammar of all of the things that we're dealing with, then we gain and build competence, right? So you start off incompetent, and then you ask who, what, where, when, why, and how. It's okay to be incompetent because that is the starting point. If, you know, you sit there and go, I'm never incompetent, I know anything, well, guess what? Then you're always going to be incompetent. And you're always going, you know, or there is no truth. Truth is arbitrary. 1 + 1 isn't 2. All this kind of nonsense, you know.
Yeah.
Just approach things with a, you know, an open heart, not necessarily an open mind, but a critical mind, and remove the contradictions and fallacies from your own thoughts.
All right. Jan Irvin, sage wisdom as all. Thank you very much for your time indeed. And I apologize for any distress or time this has soaked up from you.
And I appreciate that as well very much, Vinny. And thanks for manning up about it. You're a real man. I've seen some of this stuff go down before, and they weren't half or a third the man as you. So,
well, man, I'm going to take that as a quote and cite and put it as a citation on my website.
There. Oh, great. Yeah, taken out of context.
Yeah, totally, totally. GnosticMedia.com is the website, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you again sometime at the VinnyEastwoodShow.com.